I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Both President George Bush and his Democratic presidential rival John Kerry are on the hustings today. Kerry giving a speech from the same site in Cincinnati where 2 years ago President George Bush first outlined his concerns about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction. Today, Kerry sought to portray himself as correct on the Iraq war and President Bush as flat out wrong.
Here in Cincinnati, he promised to lead a coalition, but he failed to build the kind of broad, strong, real coalition, and he rushed to war without a plan to win the peace.
The Massachusetts senator referred in his speech to the 1,000 Americans killed in Iraq, but he didn't directly respond to Vice President Dick Cheney, who seemed to say yesterday that the country is vulnerable to another terrorist attack if Kerry is elected. Joining us on the line is reporter Jill Zuckman. She's covering the Kerry campaign for the Chicago Tribune. Jill, aides say that Kerry is striking a more combative tone in his campaign. Is he?
He certainly is. He's trying to get the upper hand right now. On the Iraq issue. It's an issue that's been plaguing him most of this year. The Bush campaign has really kind of gotten him twisted around on what he meant and how he meant it and has he changed his position. And today he was really trying to put the Bush campaign on the defense. What Senator Kerry was saying today was that because of all the miscalculations and mess-ups by the Bush administration on Iraq, the United States has been bearing the brunt of the cost of the war in Iraq and has not been able to do the things it needs to do when it comes to health care, education, the economy, and that the people in the United States are suffering for it.
Well, Jill, as you well know, Kerry's critics and supporters, some of both would say that he twisted himself up on this issue. Did he use some of the same applause lines that have gotten him into trouble in the past? Like, I would have done almost everything differently. President Bush rushed to war without a plan to win the peace, when in fact, you know, Kerry's own votes have confused people on the issue.
Well, he certainly said, you know, he would have done everything differently. In fact, one of his new lines is, I wouldn't have done just one thing differently. I would have done everything differently from President Bush. And he's sticking with that. I mean, his votes are confusing, and that is the trouble with having a senator run for president, because votes can be confusing. But he has always maintained that he was voting to give the president leverage with Iraq, that he wasn't saying just rush right out to war.
Now, the Bush-Cheney campaign is saying that Vice President Dick Cheney didn't mean in his comments yesterday to imply that a terrorist attack would occur if Kerry was elected. But the vice president did go on to say in that statement that a Kerry presidency would fall back to a pre-9/11 mindset, that terrorist acts are criminal acts and we're really not at war. Why didn't John Kerry respond to that comment?
You know, I think the Kerry campaign is trying to have Senator Kerry remain above board and talk about what he wants to talk about. Yesterday what they did was they had Senator Edwards just put out a written statement. They don't want to be jerked around by the Bush campaign every time the Bush campaign throws a punch. But Senator Kerry did, in a sense, address the substance of that, of the attack, which is, you know, I can defend this country. I will keep this nation safe. Those are things that he said today, and it sort of goes to what Cheney was implying, which was, you know, we're all going to die if we elect Senator Kerry.
Those famed undecided voters that we hear so much about, they want to know, how will a Kerry presidency bring the troops home in 4 years, as the candidate has pledged? Did he expand on that at all? Was there anything new?
Well, you know, his big focus today was really on what the Iraq War has cost the United States at home. In terms of bringing the troops home, I mean, his position is that the United States is not going to be able to get help from other countries until it gets a new president, that other countries aren't going to want to help President Bush because President Bush has essentially blown them off. And that's not really new, but he did talk about it again today.
Chicago Tribune reporter Jill Zuckman on the trail with the Kerry campaign. Jill, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now for more perspective, we turn to our military analyst, Colonel Khalif Sepp. He's professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Colonel Sepp, as we said, John Kerry says he'd like to bring the troops home in 4 years. Is that possible?
Well, logistically, yes. All the troops could be withdrawn within a matter of months. But as the question implies, the background of that is, can U.S. troops be withdrawn and U.S. policy and national security interests be maintained? This can't be accurately predicted, but there are historical precedents of American troop withdrawals that can serve as cautionary guides. Most notably, when Mr. Nixon made the decision to withdraw troops from Vietnam in conjunction with a Vietnamization program to turn more of the fighting over to the South Vietnamese, within 2 years of the withdrawal of U.S. combat troops, the South Vietnamese government collapsed and fell to the insurgency.
What can we learn from Afghanistan and apply to Iraq?
The lesson there is actually comes from the earlier war, the Soviet war, when the elder President Bush was faced with the policy success when the Soviets were finally defeated and forced to withdraw. The United States stopped all support to the resistance, and when that occurred, it allowed the Taliban to overthrow the resistance elements that we had supported, and come to power and created in large measure the sanctuary for terrorists that we're now having to come back to and deal with today.
John Kerry also speaks of bringing more allies into the war and thereby bringing the U.S. troops home sooner. Do you think that that's possible?
You know, it's feasible that a new administration could create an improved relationship with our new and old allies. But if Secretary Powell and Ambassador Armitage, who are really remarkable diplomats, if they can't manage it, it's hard to imagine that with a new president that Germany and France will start sending infantry brigades to Iraq, and that's what it would take for security there. That's the kind of force that is needed is our infantry troops. Just because we change our presidents won't change the nature of the insurgency in Iraq.
I guess the question is Senator Kerry's pledge of 4 years realistic?
I would say it's a good planning goal, but it there's just no way to tell right now how the Iraqis will be able to step up to managing how soon they'll be able to step up to managing their own security.
Colonel Sepp, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Colonel Kalev Sepp, military analyst and professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California.
During a meeting with congressional leaders today, President Bush said the U.S. is making good progress on the war on terrorism. He also took time to honor the more than 1,000 Americans lost in the Iraq War.
We mourn every loss of life. We'll honor their memories by completing a mission. We're still on the offense here in this country, chasing down these killers overseas so we don't have to face them here at home. We're making good progress. Ultimately, we will prevail.
The president now heads back to Florida after signing a disaster relief bill that'll provide that hurricane-battered state with $2 billion in federal aid. While on the campaign trail, one issue that continues to dog the president is his own military service record. Today, the Boston Globe Spotlight team reported on new developments on Bush's National Guard duty. And joining us for more is Walter Robinson of the Boston Globe. Walter, welcome.
Good day, Gail.
Walter, what does your review of President Bush's military record show, and specifically, what's new?
The review shows, as it has all along, that there were periods of time, substantial periods of time, when he was a member of the Texas Guard, that he just didn't show up, and his superiors never held him accountable for it. The news is that there are two documents, one of which has not been reported on at all. In 1968, Bush signed a document promising that he would do a certain number of days of duty per year, and if he didn't do so, that he understood he was subject to involuntary call to active duty for up to 2 years. That's number one. And he did not perform that duty in his last 2 years in the Guard up to the standards he set. And the second document is one he signed when his Guard unit in Texas let him go off to Harvard Business School in 1973, he signed a document promising to find a Air Force Reserve unit in the Boston area, at which he would have gone to drills and completed his commitment, which still had about 9 months to run, and he never did that commitment.
And how common was this at that time, moving and not following up on your Guard commitment?
Well, I don't know the answer to that. One of the president's defenders on this issue, a retired Guard colonel from Texas, says, well, there were hundreds of men who did that back then, and why are people picking on him? And I think the reason, obviously, is he's the president. And so what he did or did not do back then, just as what Senator Kerry did or did not do, deserves and ought to get greater scrutiny.
And one of the other critics of Bush's military record pointed out that the government had a considerable investment in him.
That's correct. In today's dollars, the investment is, I believe, somewhere north of $2 to $3 million to train a pilot. And back then, we can't get a precise fix on it, but it was a large amount of money. It involved about 18 months of training. And in fact, when he finished flight school, because of that, he signed another document committing himself to fly for 5 years. And he only flew for 2 years and 4 months of that.
Walter, another development today is the release of a TV ad by a group called Texans for Truth. They are linked to Democratic operatives in Texas, and they were started with funds from the liberal group MoveOn.org. The ad features a retired lieutenant colonel who served in Bush's Alabama National Guard unit who says he never saw Bush.
I heard George Bush get up and say, I served in the 187th Air National Guard in Montgomery, Alabama. Really? You know, that was my unit. And I don't remember seeing you there. So I called friends, you know, did you know that George served in our unit? No, I never saw him there.
Now, in response to that ad, a Bush spokesman said that the president had, quote, served honorably in the National Guard and was honorably discharged. Walter, your thoughts on those remarks from the Bush campaign?
Well, he did receive an honorable discharge, and that decision was made by his Texas unit. But he did not fulfill his commitment. And, you know, the White House decided months ago, back in February, that they would continue to say that he fulfilled his commitment. And the records are very clear that he did not. But he did get an honorable discharge. There's no disputing that.
Walter, thank you so much.
Happy to talk to you, Gail.
Walter Robinson of the Boston Globe Spotlight Team.
Just ahead, infants as consumers and how Madison Avenue targets them.
And later in the program, renowned chef Alice Waters serves up a different approach to school lunch.
There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
McDonald's Happy Meal turns 25 this year. First packaged and sold as a fun food for on-the-go kids, the Happy Meal has gone on to become one of the most successful advertising campaigns ever aimed at children. But our next guest doesn't see prepackaged happiness under those golden arches. Instead, a disturbing trend of kids as targeted, brand-conscious consumers. Juliet Shore is a sociologist at Boston College who's written in the past about Americans as overspent consumers. And now her new book is Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. And Juliet joins me in the studio. Hello.
Hi.
The Happy Meal seems pretty innocuous, but you really do see it as something more.
Happy Meal is actually one of the most insidious marketing promotions because it's been so effective in getting kids to ask for fast food. And, of course, we know that American kids' diets have deteriorated dramatically over exactly this period we're talking about.
On the cover, it's actually a very cute picture of a little baby inside a shopping bag, and then the title of Born to Buy. Little babies, really?
Babies are being marketed to virtually from the time they leave the womb. Now, there are infants' internet sites, And, of course, PBS, I'm sorry to say, brought us television for one-year-olds with Teletubbies and a huge licensing empire of toys, fast food, and other commercial products connected with Teletubbies. I have examples of things like infant formula bottles being branded with Pepsi-Cola logos on them, and research now being done on a significant fraction of those bottles being filled with Coke and Pepsi.
And for these characters, I'm thinking of Teletubbies or Barney or Sesame Street, what's the evidence that this really is sinking in, that these little children, even 1 year old, 18 months old, are they really taking this in and making those choices when they go with their parents to the stores?
Well, the marketers certainly have a growing body of research which says yes. At 18 months now, kids are regularly recognizing logos. At 3.5, marketers believe that kids are connecting the brand with their own specific individual personality traits. So it's not just wanting the product, but it's also being cognizant of the brand and identifying with the brand. And that's, of course, the key. They call it cradle-to-grave marketing. They believe that if they can imprint kids really young with that brand consciousness and loyalty, that it'll stick with them over their lifetimes.
You also write about a marketing trend called age compression. What is that?
Age compression is the practice typically of taking teen products, teen fashion, teen music, violent movies and programming, and marketing it to younger kids, to tweens, the 8 to 12-year-olds. And some of the stuff we're even seeing younger, 6-year-olds, for example, being targeted with real makeup, not just play makeup. The head of research at MTV Networks said to me, if it works for MTV, it'll work for Nickelodeon. That was a powerful statement of a major theme of kids' marketing now.
And what does it mean for kids when they're able to pick out brand names at so much earlier an age? Does it have a psychological effect on them, and particularly if they can't afford the brand name that they think is cool?
The research I did asked the question, how does all this exposure to media and consumer culture and the growing involvement of kids in consumer culture affect their psychological well-being? And what I found is that the more involved kids are in consumer culture, the more they care about brands, the more they're aware of them, the more they care about making money, those kinds of concerns lead to higher rates of depression, anxiety. They lead kids to have more stomach aches and headaches and other psychosomatic complaints. They lower self-esteem. It's not surprising in a way, because the message of the consumer culture is, without the product, you're nobody.
Where are kids getting the money to buy these things? I mean, is it from their allowances, their own money? Or are they being targeted because of the influence they can have on what their parents are buying?
Both. Kids today have more money than ever before. They get more money in allowances. They get money from grandparents, gifts. And they have unprecedented amounts of influence over parental purchasing. The estimates are about $670 billion a year of parental purchasing is influenced by kids. And you'd be very surprised at the kinds of products that kids now influence. The choice of car, the choice of computer, the kind of digital camera a family gets, where they go on vacation, what hotel they're going to stay at, what cruise line.
And obviously this is working very well, or the marketers and the advertisers wouldn't be doing it.
Absolutely. Parents are much more willing to empower their kids in consumer decisions, and that's a good thing in the main, I think. But marketers are taking advantage of that willingness of parents and getting kids to use what they call nag factor or pester power. So the marketers are doing an end run around the parents, trying to get the kids to nag for the stuff that the marketers want them to buy.
Sure, and at the end of a long day with a tired parent who's been perhaps working for hours and hours, that nag factor can be pretty effective.
Yes, and it's been most effective in the supermarket, where we've seen the huge impact of junk food advertising. Of course, food is the number one advertised commodity to kids. It's about 70% of the total $15 billion that is advertised to kids. And kids have unprecedented say now in the products that get purchased, and mostly it's junk food.
As you began looking into all of this and doing the research that went into the book, were you horrified?
Yes. Yes, I uncovered a lot of things. I did research inside the advertising industry. I was lucky enough to get access, unusual kind of access. And I was horrified both at what they're doing in terms of the insidiousness of the messages, the sophistication of the messages, and also the willingness of people who knew they were doing things that they didn't feel good about. And I had quite a few advertisers and marketers start confessing to me about their guilt, but their willingness to just keep on doing it. And that, in a way, was pretty horrifying to me.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Sociologist Juliet Shore is author of the new book, Born to Buy, The Commercialized Child and the New Consumer Culture. Tomorrow on Here and Now, Senate Intelligence Committee co-chair Bob Graham speaks of his outrage over the Bush-led war in Iraq. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Police chiefs from around the country rallied in Washington today, demanding that the assault weapons ban be extended. The 10-year-old ban is set to expire on Monday, leaving only 5 days to get a bill drafted, passed in the House and Senate, and to the president's desk. Los Angeles Police Chief William Bratton, speaking to us just before today's rally, said that's enough time if the president steps in.
The ultimate message is for the president to ask Congress to send him a bill rather than the lack of leadership and basically saying, well, if it gets to my desk, I'll sign it.
A gun control group called Stop the NRA ran full-page ads in major papers this week calling for an extension of the ban, while the National Rifle Association itself has launched a grassroots campaign to make sure the bill dies. Well, joining us first from Washington, D.C. is California Senator Dianne Feinstein, a Democrat from California. Senator Feinstein, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, many ask, why hasn't this issue been more out in the news? We saw a full-page ad in the New York Times from a group called StopTheNRA.com, but otherwise this hasn't really been on the radar. Why?
Well, that's an interesting thing. I've made Senate floor speeches. We've done press conferences. We've done press releases. It's been picked up in California, but I think not really nationally until lately. And I just must tell you, as the author of this legislation back in 1993, I've seen the legislation work. I know that the people of America are safer because of it. And I know that these assault weapons have become the weapon of choice for gangbangers, for those that go up against police, for those who were criminals. And I just hate to see what's happening happen, because it's going to set back this nation.
Well, you know that your opponents and even some supporters of the ban say that it actually is ineffective, that manufacturers can get around it. The NRA, and we'll be speaking to a spokesperson from the NRA in a moment, the NRA has said that there were rarely violent crimes committed by assault weapons before the ban, and there have been few since, and the passage of the bill was symbolic.
Well, then I would say to the NRA, why are you campaigning so strongly against its renewal? The fact is that it has been effective. And you see, what this law did was essentially over time, because it only prohibits the sale and manufacture of the big clips and specific weapons, it dries up their supply over time. And so over the 10-year period, the supply of these floating throughout our country has diminished. Now, that's good.
I want to go back to the issue of why this issue isn't on the radar. Some would wonder why your party's candidate, Senator Kerry, hasn't mentioned it more often. He did cast a vote in support of extending the amendment, but he hasn't mentioned it on the campaign trail. Instead, voters see him duck hunting, which lends to the belief that some have that this issue has been politicized, that the Democrats don't want to risk losing the white male voters who might support banning the ban.
Well, that's nonsense. Senator Kerry came forward, came back from the campaign trail. As a matter of fact, I called him. He cast his vote for this. I'd answer your question this way. Mm-hmm. President Bush has said that he would sign the legislation. He has said that he supports the legislation. And yet he will do nothing to bring up the legislation in the House of Representatives or to twist arms to get a positive vote to extend this legislation. We have passed it once in the Senate with 52 votes. We know we can pass it again. The key is the House of Representatives, and this is where we need the President of the United States. Now, here's someone who said he supports the bill, who said he would sign the bill, but will not lift a finger to help us get it passed and reauthorized.
Senator Feinstein, do you think if President Bush doesn't step up on this issue this week, does it have any chance of being extended?
No, I do not believe it does. And I must say it is, for me, one of the darkest times in my 12 years in the United States Senate. We worked very hard to get this passed in 1993. And the bill has worked. We could improve it, that's true. But the very forces that oppose its reauthorization oppose any improvements as well.
Senator Feinstein, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Senator Dianne Feinstein, Democrat from California, speaking to us from the Senate floor in Washington, D.C. Well, we turn now to Kelly Hobbs. She's a spokeswoman for the NRA. And Kelly, Senator Feinstein just asked, why is the NRA fighting this extension of the assault weapons ban if the NRA believes, as it said, that the ban is just a symbol, a symbolic gesture? Isn't a symbolic gesture important in a war on terror?
Well, it's a symbolic gesture in that it hasn't affected crime. This law has only impacted law-abiding citizens, and that's because these firearms are used in less than 2% of crimes. And since the law has been enacted, that number hasn't changed, contrary to false reports from anti-gun advocates.
By the way, what would law-abiding citizens be doing with assault weapons, just so we know?
Law-abiding citizens commonly use these types of firearms, and assault weapons is a name just coined by people like Dianne Feinstein to make these commonly owned rifles sound more sinister than they are. But they are commonly used for hunting purposes, they're used in competitions, and they're used for sporting reasons.
Well, you mentioned Dianne Feinstein coined the phrase. You, as you well know, the nation's police chiefs, many of them are appealing for an extension of the ban today. When they say the ban keeps guns built for warfare out of the hands of criminals without infringing on the right of citizens to bear arms for recreation or self-defense, and they are on the front lines.
The National Rifle Association is a leading law enforcement group as well. Our president is a former police chief of Des Moines, Iowa, and we have many law enforcement officers among our members. And what we're hearing from the rank and file, not the police chiefs, but the rank and file cops out there on the streets, is that they're not seeing these firearms, that these aren't the types of firearms that criminals are typically using. And we've seen from statistics from every single study out there, including a Clinton Justice Department study, that shows this law has not impacted crime, and that's because these are not the firearms that criminals typically use.
Well, you mentioned your rank and file. There's an Annenberg election survey out this week that says that even 57% of people with guns in their homes support the ban, and a third of the NRA membership supports extending the ban.
Well, I think you need to look at any study with a grain of salt. We've seen that same study, and it's probably well worth noting they didn't necessarily talk to the National Rifle Association member. It was asked if one was in the household.
How do you respond to Senator Feinstein and other critics who say that it's politically dangerous at a time like this to withhold your endorsement of President Bush until September 13th? It's sort of a political extortion.
The National Rifle Association always holds our endorsement until October. At the same time, this is an important issue to gun owners, and we will be watching and waiting until the 13th is passed.
So, in other words, your withholding of your support, your endorsement, has nothing to do with his stand on the ban.
No. We always wait until the fall to make endorsements.
Will you endorse President Bush if he steps up this week, as Senator Feinstein is asking, and encourages Congress to extend the ban? Will you endorse President Bush if he extends the ban?
We would certainly take that into consideration, but we haven't made any announcements as far as endorsements are concerned at this time.
Kelly, thank you.
Thank you.
Kelly Hobbs, spokeswoman for the NRA.
Still to come, school lunch with organic produce. Renowned chef Alice Waters thinks it's possible.
You're listening to Here and Now.
By some accounts, there are now more slaves in the world than at any time in history. 27 million men, women, and children. More than even at the height of the transatlantic slave trade. Most modern-day slaves live in Asia, in India, Pakistan, and other countries where extreme poverty is common. But slavery also exists in the Americas, particularly in Brazil, where an estimated 40,000 people live in bondage. Andrew Downey reports from Brazil for the Christian Science Monitor and recently traveled into the Amazon forest, part of a mission to find and free the slaves. Andrew, thanks for being with us.
Hi.
You traveled with one of Brazil's seven mobile anti-slavery units. Tell us a little bit about this unit.
And their main task is to go into the forest or wherever they believe there are slaves, to find the slaves and to free them and to make sure they get paid for the work they've done. When President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva came to power in 2003, he made one of his goals to eradicate slavery in Brazil, and he increased the number of units from 4 to 7.
And who are the slaves who are being brought into the forest? Are these people who can't find work elsewhere, or how does this work exactly?
The slaves who are found in the forest are generally peasants, they're country people who haven't found work anywhere else. People come and offer them work with promises of payment afterwards, and they accept it. And then they find once they get there that they're not being paid, that the conditions are horrific.
How so?
Mostly they are kept in the forest. They sleep under branches. Often all they have for protection is a black plastic sheet. They have no running water, no toilets. It really is awful conditions that you see them living in.
And no matter how many hours they work or how long they work for, they're never able to get ahead. I mean, even if they are paid, they still wind up themselves being in debt to the people who supposedly hired them?
Yeah, because what mostly happens is the ranchers, they take them to the forest and then they say, okay, we're going to give you X amount of dollars for X amount of weeks, but they charge them for the food that they're given, or they charge them for the gasoline they use for their chainsaws, or they charge them for clothes or security. So they end up, when the time is finished, they actually end up owing the rancher, or they get very, very little money because they've already had so much taken off.
And basically there's no way out?
There's a lot of times the places are just so remote that it's very difficult for them to get out. But yeah, in many cases, they are actually being held against their will.
So it's actually somewhere between indentured servitude and slavery.
Yeah, the Brazilian government used the term slaves. The International Labor Organization, which has lauded Brazil's efforts in the last few years, they also used the word slaves.
And when you drove in with this mobile anti-slavery unit, what happened?
We were following up a report of slavery by one slave who had managed to get out. We went into the jungle. We drove 4 hours from the nearest town, and we knew there was probably 30, 40 of them. And we basically said to them, listen, we're here to let you get out. We tracked down the owner of the land who had hired them, and they secured payment for all the workers. Some of them received several $100, more money than they'd ever seen in their life. And they were, of course, delighted.
So at least there was a happy ending for the group that you saw. Who are the people who are holding these slaves, and what, if anything, happens to them?
Generally, these people are landowners, big farmers who have ranches in the Amazon. They are forced to pay back pay to the workers. They're also almost always forced to pay a fine. But it's very, very rare to get criminal prosecutions for this kind of crime.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Andrew Downey reports from Brazil for the Christian Science Monitor. For more on slavery in Brazil, you can go to our website, here-now.org.
Stay with us. There's more ahead here.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
From adding more fruits and vegetables to forbidding birthday cupcakes, school administrators are scrambling to update lunch menus in response to the rising levels of obesity in kids. Alice Waters, the visionary chef and teacher who started the organic food revolution nearly 30 years ago, is also turning her attention to the problem of children's health with a program called the Edible Schoolyard. It's a project she founded at a Berkeley middle school where kids grow, harvest, and cook their own fruits and vegetables. Here now, Scott Haas joined Alice in the garden where she explained the program.
Well, this is a project that we started here about 9 years ago. And it came about because the principal here called and felt like Chez Panisse and I could be of some help.
Chez Panisse being your restaurant in Berkeley.
Yes. Yes. Could be some help beautifying the school, which was pretty run down at the time. And I had made a comment in the press, in fact, about the state of a public school in an enlightened place like Berkeley. It looked abandoned. And it's right between my home and Chez Panisse. And I just was shocked to see kids coming into this dilapidated building and walking on asphalt that was broken up. And
so where we're standing now used to be asphalt? Is that what you're saying?
This all was asphalt 9 years ago.
And now it's got waist-high plants. These are all, because it's called the Edible Schoolyard, I'm assuming that everything I'm looking at is, in fact, edible.
Pretty much everything in this garden, aside from some beautiful little flowers, but most of those are, in fact, edible.
And what's the purpose of it? I mean, how does this play into a normal day of education?
I've been very worried about the future of our kids. I'm worried about the sort of disconnect that they have with what's going on in our culture, how the family table has basically fallen apart. And kids have been fed the values and the food of Fast Food Nation. And I've been aware of this and passionate about this for a long time, and I've come from a Montessori teaching.
Your background is that you were a Montessori teacher?
Before I started Chez Panisse, I was a Montessori teacher.
Oh, wow.
I taught little tiny children, 3 to 6, but I really believed in the hands-on aspect of education.
So from a nutritional standpoint, what is growing here? These are organic vegetables?
Well, this is definitely an organic garden. Yeah, it sort of began and with the kids' involvement and their design, and it grew very, very slowly.
How does it fit in a curriculum where they're being taught English or history or math? I mean, what's the relationship of the garden to their ordinary educational day? I mean, do they come to the garden every single day?
This is one of the pieces of this project. We're building a cafeteria, and that's when kids are going to have an everyday experience of relating to food in an entirely different way.
This is one school. Are there other schools in Berkeley that have this program too?
Well, we would like to do this in every school, not only in Berkeley, but every school in the country.
How are you going to do that with changing seasons?
Well, we're going to have to do some greenhousing.
Okay.
And we're going to have to, and some places there in the city may only have some edible landscaping that goes up the walls, or maybe it's on the rooftops. In New York City, there are many planted roofs.
Here comes a chicken. Now, this is a free-range chicken, free-range eggs.
Definitely a free-range chicken.
What has been the reaction of some of the families of these kids here? Have they been in favor? Have they been saying, well, this is kind of an upper-middle-class liberal idea? I mean, have they been behind the idea?
They have been completely behind it. And some are more involved than others, but there's a great interest in getting their kids into this school, which is the reason that we want to move it into all the schools in Berkeley so that we can have a really good model. But this is really about school lunch.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't really about making a garden. That's part of this. But what we're doing is we're taking school lunch out of the maintenance side of the equation, and we're putting it in the academic side of the equation so that all the kids are asked to be part of this core curriculum every day. And what we're going to do is enrich that experience, make it a hands-on experience, so that the kids are really changed. I think it's a transformational experience, so that we're not just giving, sort of upgrading the school lunch. We're transforming the school lunch.
So this is really not an abstract project based on healthy eating outside of a context of mental and physical health.
Absolutely. Trying to address all of the problems in a way that is really pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's bringing kids to these difficult ideas through a sensual experience. Have them engaged in having their hands in the ground and smelling the fennel and picking the flowers here.
You know what's ironic about it, too? When you think about the backgrounds of some of these kids, when you talk about the diversity, I bet that some of them, their grandparents and great-grandparents, had that experience, but it skipped a couple of generations. So it's really a return to roots, so to speak.
Exactly. No, it's exactly. I mean, before the war, we mostly had organic gardens. And people did have memories, at least, you know, our grandparents did. And especially from the Midwest, when I talk to people there, they all know somebody who came from a dairy farm or a little, you know, were raising chickens in a civilized way. But things have dramatically changed, and it's that big business that's happening and internationally shipping food all around the world, and we have to come back to our senses and back to our roots.
We're leaving the garden, and now we're going into the edible schoolyard kitchen. And in front of me, there are four tables of middle schoolers staring at me, wondering what I'm doing and eating all the vegetables that they have helped grow and harvest. What's your name?
Rayanne.
What are you learning from working in the garden?
Science.
Yeah, what he said.
What did he say?
Science.
Tell me something you learned.
Photosynthesis.
What?
Photosynthesis.
Nitrogen.
Uh-huh.
Tell me your name.
Saeed.
So, Saeed, you're on your second carrot.
Actually, more like eighth.
More like eighth. So, what do you find interesting about working in this garden?
Well, I think it's really nice because our last school had a garden, but we didn't get to work in it.
What did you learn?
Well, we learned how to plant things. I learned that there's more than just putting a seed on the floor. We're kind of self-sufficient.
Tell me your name.
Maurice.
What do you think of this garden?
Great, because it has a lot of fruits and vegetables.
So what have you learned working in the garden?
Pollen spreads and what kind of fruits and vegetables there are.
What are some of the favorite vegetables you've had in this garden?
Cabbages and greens.
Tell me your name.
Langston.
What are some of the favorite vegetables you've had in the garden?
Greens, carrots, and collard greens.
That's very cool. Well, thank you, guys. So Alice, what have you learned being part of this project?
I confirmed a lot of my beliefs that about children and about eating habits, and it's very reassuring.
What were some of the unique challenges that came up working with characters this age?
It's difficult to get their attention. And so I thought if it worked here, then it could work in the whole school system. And what's happening is when kids are engaged in the process of the growing and the cooking, that they want to eat it. And that's very reassuring. And we're not just talking about, you know, easy things like pizza. We're talking about greens and bitter salads, food that would normally kids would reject.
How many biscuits can you eat this morning? How many biscuits can you eat this evening? How many biscuits can you eat? 49 and a half this morning, this evening, right now.
Here and now is Scott Haas speaking with Chef Alice Waters at her edible schoolyard in Berkeley, California. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
This morning, ain't no use of me working so hard this evening. Ain't no use of me working so hard. I got a pretty woman in the boss yard this morning. Get badges on.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.